You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Two arrests have been made in the Caldor Fire, a wildfire encompassing three counties and cresting over Echo Summit this summer, burning more than 200,000 acres, destroying more than 1,000 structures, and forcing 53,000 people from their homes. The arrests are on the heels of state lawmakers holding a long-awaited wildfire oversight hearing, following a series of investigative reports by CAP Radio. That hearing was initially scheduled earlier this summer. CAP Radio state government reporter Scott Rodd covered the Caldor Fire, and his investigation led to the delayed wildfire oversight hearing. Scott joins us now. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Vicky. How are you?
So, Scott, you're literally en route to El Dorado County. I think I just heard your door open right out of your car. Where the arrests were announced last night or yesterday afternoon, what have you learned so far?
Well, details are still somewhat scant. Yeah, so I'm heading up to El Dorado County right now to actually go to the courthouse to try to get some more information. The announcement that was made from the DA simply said that two men had been arrested, accused of potentially starting this fire, 66-year-old David Scott Smith and 32-year-old Travis Shane Smith. It's a father and son. And again, you know, details exactly as to how they may have started this fire, that remains very unclear. You know, I pressed the DA to try to get the warrant that was issued. It was a special type of warrant that typically is issued somewhat sort of early on in an investigation compared to a typical or normal warrant, but they wouldn't release it. That's why I'm headed to the courthouse right now.
I mean, talking about or just expanding on the challenges that you are running into with the district attorney's office, is this typical or usual when you're doing this type of reporting?
I found it, I don't know if odd or maybe frustrating is the right word. This is a public document. Typically, right. You know, when an announcement like this is made, they will release, you know, documents in relation to it in order for the press to be able to report as fully and accurately as possible. And so the refusal to release this warrant, in my experience, is a little unusual. And again, you know, our goal here is to try to get as much information and as clear of information as possible. 53,000 people were evacuated from this fire. There were over 1,000 structures destroyed, over 220,000 acres burned. I mean, this fire impacted so many people. And when the announcement came out, there was a real hunger by survivors to try to get more information, and deservedly so.
Well, since learning of these arrests, have you been able to connect with any of those residents who were evacuated?
Yeah, I did speak with one resident. His name is Mark Elmer. He actually leads the Fire Safe Council in Grizzly Flats. That's the town that was basically, you know, 2/3 of it was destroyed by the fire. He was fortunate enough that his home was spared, but I visited him at his home and his entire neighborhood was basically reduced to ash, very tragically. And, you know, he said that he thinks that the arrests and, you know, if this moves on to prosecution, will bring some peace of mind to survivors. But he said ultimately, you know, many of the people he knows are trying to move along in the process and trying to sort of, you know, put their lives back together. So he said this will bring peace of mind to many people, but also there are still some challenges ahead.
Yeah. And as we've learned from previous wildfires, that road to rebuilding can span years. The Caldor Fire started August 14th near Omo Ranch. It burned for more than 2 months, more than 60 days. And as you mentioned, nearly wiped out the community of Grizzly Flats. Given that you have been to that area, can you remind us of the terrain where the wildfire originated?
Yeah, it's heavily, densely forested area, very rugged terrain. You know, there are steep canyons, you know, basically jutting up from rivers that create almost sort of a furnace kind of situation where if a fire starts, as it did in this situation near the Middle Fork of the Consumnes River, it can really just sort of take off up these canyons, which is exactly what it did. And of course, it's not just the terrain, but we've been experiencing a serious, severe drought And these forests are have been unmanaged, I should say. There hasn't been a whole lot of prescribed burning or thinning that's been happening in these in this forest area. There's been some, but not a whole lot. And so that essentially laid the ground for a fire that could ignite and take off and, you know, not only burn through Grizzly Flats, but crest over the Sierra. It's the only the second fire to ever do that. The first was earlier this year, the Dixie Fire, and cause a significant amount of destruction.
Yeah. You actually covered the Dixie Fire. You covered multiple wildfires this year. I'm curious, when covering the Caldor Fire initially, did anything seem or indicate that this could potentially be intentionally or recklessly caused?
You know, it was unclear. I believe that there is some recreation that is in the area where the fire started. So, you know, that led some to believe that potentially it could have been human caused. But, you know, these investigations take a lot of time. The investigators are very thorough in terms of trying to determine how a fire starts. And so, you know, there was some speculation, but, you know, we really were just waiting for investigators to announce what they found. And of course, sometimes they announce that, you know, there wasn't a finding. So, you know, there was speculation, but we really were waiting for investigators to come forth.
This has been a pretty busy week for you, Scott. You went to a wildfire oversight hearing on Tuesday, the day before. What was the tone amongst lawmakers? This was a delayed hearing. I think it was delayed for months, correct?
That's right. It was originally scheduled for a few months ago. And the tone amongst lawmakers was, you know, a mixture of curiosity and at times frustration. You know, they really were pressing for more information than they were given, or perhaps, you know, pressing for the release of data and transparency that the state's sort of technical infrastructure isn't quite prepared to deliver. So that's where some of the frustration came from.
You know, they were discussing $1.5 billion, which was allocated this year for forest management and wildfire prevention. You cover this very in-depthly. What new information did you learn about how this could be spent?
So, you know, one thing that was said at the beginning of the hearing by Democratic Assemblyman Richard Bloom, he said, dollars alone will not prevent wildfires. We must ensure that these fuel reduction and community protection projects are done in a timely and equitable manner. And I thought that was an interesting way to set the tone for this hearing, because there's been a lot of kind of congratulatory press releases and, you know, sort of ovation from lawmakers and the governor about this record-setting investment in fire prevention and forest management. And it is a tremendous amount of money. It's more than the state has ever spent before. But this signaling that dollars alone, putting money in a pot somewhere, won't prevent fires, I think was an important sort of tone to set. And so, you know, going into this, that kind of, I think, was a preamble for a lot of the questions that came forward from lawmakers. You know, Republicans were especially sharp in their questions. They wanted to know how this money was being spent. They wanted to know exactly how many acres were going to be treated or managed by this money. They were given some details, for example, about a third of that money, half a billion dollars, is going towards about 260 projects. There may be more on the way from that money. But the state officials couldn't give official or estimated totals in terms of how many acres were going to be treated or managed. And that, you know, kind of some lawmakers were bristling at not being able to get that level of detail.
Well, $1.5 billion is one thing. Spending it wisely, as you're talking about, is completely another matter. And acreage is one thing as well, but also choosing the right location to invest this prevention and mitigation work is also important, right?
Oh, absolutely. You know, there's a lot of land in California. It's a big state with a lot of forest land, wild land, chaparral. And so, you know, this $1.5 billion, while it is a tremendous amount of money, it will not treat, you know, most of the state by any means. It can make, you know, a good decent dent in what should be done in a year or in several years, which most experts say we should be aiming for about 1 million acres a year. We're well short of that right now. And so, you know, it is a lot of money, but lawmakers were really pressing to figure out where was this work being done? How do we ensure that not only that it's getting done, but that it's being done in a way where it's protecting the most vulnerable communities? And they got some of that information. You know, there is a mapping system that's available through the state that shows where some of these projects are. But CAL FIRE Chief Tom Porter, who I should note is going to retire actually just tomorrow after 3 years leading the department, he said that, you know, this system of mapping out these prevention projects, it'll probably take another year or so for it to be fully fleshed out. And then there could be some additional delays as they continue to work out some of the technical kinks. And so lawmakers, again, were a bit frustrated with that, especially Republican lawmakers. They felt it was essential that they get real time or as close to real time information as possible to legislate, but also for the public to be able to understand where is this work being done and is my community being protected?
Well, it just seems like concrete information is still being hashed out when it comes to this funding. And this hearing was prompted by your reporting, which found Governor Newsom significantly overstated his administration's accomplishments on wildfire management and prevention. What did lawmakers say about that?
You know, there were references to our reporting, and essentially, you know, they pointed to it to say we need more transparency. You know, we need to see exactly what kind of work is being done. You know, we can't take for granted that you know, projects will be set and that necessarily the acres will be completed. And so they really wanted to get a clearer picture. One that was more data driven, and they pointed to our reporting, which found inconsistencies in the past and in what was sort of communicated as being completed. Hmm.
Before we let you go, Scott, this year wildfires burned more than 3 million acres, destroyed over 3,000 homes, following a record-setting 4 million acres just last year. During that time, there's really been this push to make the public aware about where and when fire fuel management is happening. How is that going?
You know, there has been, I've definitely noticed more public announcements coming from both CAL FIRE and the U.S. Forest Service, giving the public a heads up on when there's going to be prescribed burning, when they may see or hear forest thinning, mastication, which is kind of like essentially crushing up a lot of the smaller vegetation and smaller trees that can serve as fuel for fire. So there definitely has been more outreach and attempts at education as well. You know, I think for a lot of people, when they first hear about intentional fires being set in the forest, it comes as sort of a foreign idea. But fire has become, over many, many centuries, many thousands of years, a natural part of the wildlands in California. And so having suppressed it for about 100 years, that was kind of an unnatural break. So there definitely has been a push to educate the public that fire can be a good thing in a lot of ways for the forest, especially if it's introduced in a controlled and responsible manner.
Right. Not only a threat, but a tool as well. Scott, thank you for joining us. Drive safe.
Thanks.
And that is CAP Radio state government reporter Scott Rodd. Up next, it's been called the worst fraud in California history. Billions of dollars in fraudulent unemployment claims. Many of you were impacted, but a documentary follows the money to see just how insidious EDD's backlog goes. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. $20 billion. Let's let that sink in. $20 billion. That's the estimated amount of money California's Employment Development Department, or EDD, has lost to fraud since the pandemic locked down California, causing economic hardship. The EDD, at the direction of Governor Newsom, lowered the guardrails and fraud protections, allowing people to file for unemployment assistance in order to get them money as quickly as possible. The net result is an estimated $20 billion in losses, including widespread fraud within jails and prisons, while people were waiting weeks, months for rightful unemployment payments. An investigative documentary project is taking a deeper look at how this happened and the far-reaching insidious impacts. From a real estate agent who found dozens of EDD envelopes at a home to even a law enforcement agency needing to use a moving truck to see so many fraudulent purchases, even a brand new Mercedes. The documentary, Easy Money, Fraud, Fortune, and Failures, will air this Sunday on KCRA Channel 3. Dave Manucheri is the producer and the director and joins us now. Welcome, Dave.
Thanks, Vicki. Nice to be here.
You know, you and I both covered this pretty significantly. And I remember in the beginning when talking to people and getting these tips, people would say that they were waiting a couple weeks and they hadn't received their payments, and that would turn into months. And we would think that these were isolated incidents. Obviously, now with hindsight, we know that that is far from the case. Is this level of fraud unique to California, or did other states see similar issues during the pandemic?
Other states did see similar issues. In fact, Colorado just had a legislative hearing where they were looking at it, but the numbers are far lower. I get that California has sort of the highest population, but we seem to have paid out the highest amount of fraud, and it was the easiest for fraudsters to hit. So it became well known that if you wanted to get money, mm-hmm. California was a place to go because it was just sort of flying out the door. So other states did see it and continue to see it, but not to the level that we did here in California.
I mean, you've covered the troubles at EDD for a long time. It predates the pandemic. It goes back at least a decade, if not longer. There was an audit nearly a decade ago, you know, detailing really just problems within the unemployment system at the state. But what surprised you about what you learned about this pandemic fraud?
What didn't? It got worse and worse as we went on. The beginning of the pandemic, we already knew that EDD was going to have problems. This is a department that had stopped answering the phone after noon, claiming lack of people, lack of money, which was something that was sort of repeated for more than a decade, right? So we knew that they were going to have issues just trying to get the unemployment going. What the surprise sort of came that not only did they circle the wagons like they always tended to, it was that the fraud would unfold and literally no information came from EDD and even less probably from the governor's office. It just continued to sort of spiral until there was no choice but to sort of start answering questions. And that came after you, me, and other outlets around the state started covering stacks and stacks of envelopes and money going out the door, and literally millions of people who were still sitting there 6 months later, 8 months later, unable to get their benefits. It's just the backlog didn't surprise us. The fraud did. There's always fraud, but the spectacular amount that this was just bowled everybody over.
Yeah, I mean, I remember I covered this damning press conference about a year ago with DAs across the state. They uncovered widespread fraud within jails and prisons. We're talking tens of thousands of claims. Essentially, friends and family of inmates applying for EDD benefits, cashing bank cards, sending money orders back to inmates. At that time, it was believed to be $1 billion in fraud. We're now talking about $20 billion in fraud. What did you learn since then, which led you to the documentary now?
Well, one of the things that we looked at was that everybody knew a little piece of this, right? Everybody knew about envelopes. Everybody knew the number. At the time when we started working on this, it was somewhere near 10 or 11 billion is what EDD was claiming. And what we realized is everybody saw, it was like a puzzle. Everybody saw a little piece of it. Nobody saw the full picture. And we even realized that while we covered it here in Sacramento and sort of dabbled in things around the state and around the country, is that we didn't really see or hadn't portrayed the full picture. People couldn't wrap their head around $10 billion.
It's
exactly
overwhelming.
Just how much that was, right? So we decided that the only way we were going to do that is to go out and rather than, you know, the face on a screen, the Zoom interviews, we wanted to go and be where people were at. And do that to sort of show how it unfolded. Even then, the things that we found were surprising. It just the ripple effect of this fraud was continuing to happen and is continuing to happen.
I mean, your investigation took you all over the state. That is a very broad area for widespread fraud. How did you track down the people in this documentary?
Well, we were lucky to have been covering this for 18 months already. We had done individual stories. I'd been knee deep in it since the pandemic began last year in 2020. So a lot of it was reaching out to people. And, you know, we continue to get, in terms of normal people who couldn't get their benefits or got tax forms that they weren't even paid for, we were getting emails. So we had a database of all those people that we would reach out to. But at the end of the day, we started reaching out to district attorneys and to law enforcement and legislators. And what was interesting is, you know, these are people that an investigative unit generally has sort of a combative relationship with. It was really surprising to us how, particularly when we went to Southern California, to towns like Torrance and Riverside, that their police departments were not just willing to talk to us, but like opened the doors and gave us tons of information and things that we weren't prepared to see. And suddenly we were seeing a far broader scope of problems that came as a result of this.
Hmm. We're going to listen to some of those encounters. Let's start off in Beverly Hills. You spoke to a boutique owner who just didn't think something just didn't seem right after sales started to increase in the middle of a pandemic. Talk to us about that interaction.
Yeah, this is a gentleman. He owns a store called Kitson. There are like three different locations. He has them in Los Angeles and Beverly Hills. Fraser Ross is the owner's name. We went to him and it was just surprising. We knew there were arrests in Beverly Hills and L.A. What we didn't know was just how crazy things were. And so when we talked to him, he said, you know, right after they opened up, right after the statewide shutdown had sort of lifted, business didn't just like start back up. It went so crazy that he knew something was wrong. People were coming in and spending tens of thousands of dollars in one sitting per person. And he just, when he started seeing stacks of EDD cards coming in, that's when he knew something was wrong.
Mm. Well, we went from closed. I mean, we had curbside pickup. We went open till, you know, the traffic was insane. I mean, people were coming in with wads of cash. Really, there was no, you didn't really have to sell them anything. They were just taking whatever they wanted and going into the cash. It looked like, you know, all of a sudden I said that there was a lottery. You know, they won the lottery. They were certainly renting the best cars in LA. The rentals were hot. You could see more Rolls Royces in LA all of a sudden. You know, it was not unnormal to get a $3,000 sale every 2 hours.
It's crazy that these jewelry stores in Rodeo Drive are having people walk in with staggering amounts of cash and EDD cards to buy things.
There's something up. I'm telling you, this is not normal. If you're on unemployment, how are you buying these slippers from Paris for $125?
Right. How was it walking down the street at Rodeo Drive? I mean, was it easy finding business owners or just people who were actually kind of echoed what this business owner was telling you?
It was somewhat. Not a lot of them did not want to go on camera with us. And that was difficult. Fraser was really open about it. He was confounded by it. You know, one of the things he brought up was most of those boutique stores along Rodeo Drive are Italian, British, European, and all of that money got sent to Gucci and Cartier. And, you know, he was frustrated because, you know, he's an American store owner and all that money was getting shipped overseas. And so that was one. The other was that, you know, when we started talking to these folks and we weren't able to put this in the documentary, but we talked to even parking attendants. And the parking attendants were telling us, look, it's not unusual for us to park a Maserati when we're parking it on Rodeo Drive. But the traffic was so bad right when they opened up because of all these people coming in with EDD cards and money that's how the police department started coming in. It was a traffic problem. They couldn't get cars on the street and they would go to park the car and in the passenger seat in the back seat would be stacks of opened envelopes from EDD that these people were literally grabbing the EDD cards, parking the Maserati that they either bought or rented, and then going and buying jewelry and coach purses and whatever they could get their hands on.
Wow. You also met a real estate agent in Southern California who was taking pictures of a home when they bumped into the mail carrier. What was that about?
So this is Don Scordino. He's the former head of the Fresno Real Estate Agents Association. We had heard early on that there were vacant homes were kind of a target because the fraudsters, the way the fraud played out is people learned how to do this and they would get the cards sent to a vacant home, for example, and nobody's looking or paying attention. So they could either go to the mailbox or try to break in the house, and they would get the envelopes out of the house. So this man is taking pictures of the house, and envelopes start showing up, and nobody's been in the house for over a year. And the names are people who never lived at the house. And it was sort of the first steps of how suddenly they're realizing how this fraud was starting to play out.
I was at a vacant home doing some pictures inside, and mail carrier came and dropped off three envelopes. And I thought, well, that's kind of strange because nobody's lived here for over a year. I went and looked, and it was three totally unrelated names, but the correct address. So I went and took them back to the mail carrier who was walking around the neighborhood and gave them to her. And she said, oh, thank you very much. I'll give them to the supervisor. This seems to be happening a lot now.
I'm also just curious, how does social media play a role in all of this?
Social media, interestingly enough, and this is one of the surprises that we ran into, was because law enforcement, Torrance, Riverside, Sacramento, all of these folks, even the district attorneys, like that prison press conference that you talked about, they couldn't get EDD to even answer the phone for them. They were having the same frustrations that we were. So departments like Torrance started going, well, you know what we're going to do? We're just going to monitor social media. We'll look for either EDD or we'll look for people who have tons of money. And they started spotting people who were more or less bragging about, look, I got all this money. I got it from EDD. It was really simple. And look at all of the things I bought. And it was just crazy how much that they were able to find that way to try and tackle the fraud.
So there was one person in particular who was showing all kinds of video and pictures of him having stacks of cash on the dash of his car and then bragging about how he's furnishing his house with a brand new refrigerator and buying his mom a Mercedes. But because of there was so much evidence, detectives had to rent a U-Haul box truck to go with us on the search warrant. So when we served that search warrant, we ended up seizing all that evidence, which included the refrigerator, the washer and dryer, the laptops, the tablets, the shoes, and even mom's brand new Mercedes. Mom was not happy about losing her Mercedes.
I mean, you're talking about, I mean, the documentary is called Easy Money, and this is on social media showing huge stacks of cash. Was there essentially a roadmap for some people? Like, this is how you accomplish this?
Absolutely. You know, EDD, when they finally did start talking about the fraud, which didn't start happening until late fall, even early winter of 2020, the criminals knew, and EDD would start talking about organized crime rings. And there was some of that. Don't get me wrong. There were foreign actors. There were criminal rings that were working on this. But it was also individuals. So talk about either the dark web or even just social media. People were talking about it's really easy to do this. And there became a line item on Telegram, which is sort of a messaging board that a lot of these criminals would use. And pandemic unemployment assistance, which was the PUA, which was the system that you could use if you were a freelancer to get unemployment. And it was the first time that had ever happened that people who were freelancers could get unemployment. That was where the majority of this money was coming from. So people would sell tutorials and walk them line by line on how to fill out the application for PUA at California's EDD and sell you for dirt cheap a list of people's identifying information, social security number, address, date of birth, everything you need as a fledgling criminal to apply for benefits. And since EDD was allowing people to back time, you could apply in August and say you hadn't worked since March, and you would get one card with $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 on it and drain the card and do it all over again with somebody else's identification.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio, and if you're just joining us, we're talking with Dave Manucherry, the producer and director of the upcoming KCRA 3 documentary about fraud at EDD titled Easy Money, Fraud, Fortune, and Failures. How is EDD going to try and reclaim some of this money, or just really has it just vanished?
It's an interesting quandary, right? We've asked that question of a lot of people. You know, one of the first questions we asked was, if this was a regular business, would they be able to handle this? And I don't think there's any business, no matter how large, could handle a $20 billion loss. one of the things we've found out is, yeah, they've been able to seize some of the money. Even if they get it back, it's going to be pennies on the dollar. Most of this has evaporated. But another weird sort of thing that we found out, if it's a federal investigation, they can seize everything. They can seize the Mercedes. They can seize the washer dryer, the laptops. Under state law, really the only thing you can do under what's called asset forfeiture is seize drug-related money and things. So unless they can specifically say that this is EDD fraud, they can't take the Maserati or the Mercedes or the washer dryer or the cash. If it's an EDD card, they can take that, but they still have to prove that it's fraud. And one of the things that these departments have been running into is this is sort of that ripple effect again, that EDD is requiring all the law enforcement divisions to serve warrants on EDD to get the fraudulent applications. But these departments have been waiting a year in some cases to try and get the warrants returned to get that documentation, and they don't have it. So they can't charge these people with anything more than maybe a weapons charge or a drug charge if they've got it. If they can't get that documentation or the statute of limitations runs out before they do, these guys walk off with a Mercedes and cash and money orders and everything, and there's nothing the state can do about it.
What has your interaction been with EDD during the course of this documentary and also just like the reporting for nearly 2 years?
It's been combative. You know, for 18 months, Brian Heap, our 4 o'clock anchor, and I both had sort of hammered on EDD, asking for, initially it was for the backlog, for the people who couldn't get their funds. And initially we were told there is no backlog. Everything's fine. Everything's working. For the documentary, you know, we tried for months to try and get the current director, Rita Sines, to go on camera. And all we would get was a lot of emails telling us what they thought we should be talking about in our documentary, but not really putting anybody from EDD in front of the camera. The closest we got is McGregor Scott, the former U.S. attorney, who has been hired as an independent contractor by the governor to sort of address a lot of this fraud. And he is doing a lot of good work, but he's only been in there a few months. But as for EDD, they've been very opaque. There's been little to no information garnered back and forth. And Director Sines has yet to go on camera with anyone, really, about any of what she's supposedly done or improved or fixed in the last almost year that she's been in charge of the department.
What about Governor Newsom? Any response from his office or the governor himself?
You know, we tried for the last 3 months to get Governor Newsom to go on camera. You know, the initial response was, unfortunately, we're unable to accommodate your request. We then informed them exactly what we had, which was people from both sides of the aisle. This was a nonpartisan issue that were pointing fingers, not just at EDD, but at leadership at the governor's office that allowed this to happen, that sort of ignored all of the problems in an effort to just get money out the door because they were tired of hearing about the backlog. Initially, the governor's office seemed interested in talking to us and then ultimately decided they did not want to speak with us. We wanted to get as much information out of him and from Director Sines as we could, because that was our goal here, is to shine a light on exactly what happened and what's being done to fix the problem. As a result, we've had to go around and talk to others that are involved in the system to see what changes can or will be made.
I mean, we're talking about $20 billion, but that really is an estimate of how much money was lost. I mean, you're hearing that it could be much, much worse.
Yes, we spoke to an economic crimes detective in Riverside who's been doing this kind of fraud detection since for about 30 years now almost. And he said, you know, when you hear the number like EDD is tossing out, it's $20 billion. And he says, when you hear that number, that's just the beginning.
So you can put this on camera if you'd like. What I know about fraud is that most often what we see is just on the surface, that there are layers and layers beneath that. So if someone were to come up and tell me that there's $30 billion in EDD fraud, I would increase that by 4 or 5 times because generally that's how fraud works. We only see what's on the surface. If you really dig into it and start processing it and start investigating it even further, there's going to be multiple layers to it. I would say, in my estimation, just if you want to say call a layman's estimation, then I would say we're probably going to creep up close to 100 billion.
I just feel so heavy with that, given that, you know, you're talking about if anything's going to be recouped, it's like pennies on the dollar.
Absolutely. And to give a little bit of credit, when he says 100 billion, he's talking about the ultimate cost, right? So it's not 100 billion just dollars paid out to fraudsters, but it's going to talk about the ultimate cost, the fact that departments are spending 80 to 90% of their time investigating EDD, people who should have gotten that money who didn't, people who are going to pay tax bills just to keep the IRS off their backs for money that they never got because somebody stole their identity. When you get done, he said this is going to be years in the making, that they're going to have to clean this mess up. And it's going to take a long time. This is sort of the legacy of the pandemic for both EDD and for the governor.
Dave, thanks for joining us. And great work.
Thank you so much.
That is Dave Manucherry, KCRA producer and director, who is going to be unveiling a documentary, Easy Money, which will air on KCRA Sunday night. Still ahead, a generous concert in more ways than one kicks off this weekend, a 20-voice a cappella ensemble, and the singers are donating all proceeds to underfunded charities. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. The Reconciliation Singers, Voices of Peace, or RSVP, is a 20-voice a cappella ensemble based in Sacramento. The singers donate all proceeds from their concerts to underfunded charities nationwide, with a focus on Sacramento. RSVP has two concerts coming up tomorrow and Saturday alongside guest artist Dear Darling, and a new song written just for RSVP and Dear Darling will be premiered. Joining us now are RSVP's artistic director and Cap Radio's classical host, Jennifer Reason, president of RSVP Board of Directors, Grant Mulligan, and members of Dear Darling, Hannah Kyle and Natalie Hagwood. Welcome all to Insight.
Thank you, Vicky. Good morning, everybody.
Well, Jennifer, I just want to start off with you. Your talents just continue to surprise me. I had no idea you can sing as well.
I do love to sing. Thank you.
When did you take over as artistic director of RSVP?
Well, it shocked me to find out that it was actually 8 years ago. So I joined the group as a singer in 2008. And then, 8 years ago, I've been in charge.
What drew you to the ensemble?
Well, honestly, first it was the music. I went to a concert and the blend was so amazing and the singing just felt so top notch. But then when I found out that they were doing it for just such great causes, like, oh, I have to be a part of this.
Grant, turning to you, what is RSVP's mission?
Our mission simply is to bring people together through the arts and give back to the community in a way that makes a lasting difference. We support charities and raise not only funds for them through the concerts, but raise awareness. We try to get people engaged in local community activities and service opportunities in ways they just aren't aware of until they meet these new groups at our concerts.
What are some of the organizations and charities that you donate to after these shows?
Charities that we've supported in the past include groups like Joshua's House Hospice, which is a new hospice facility for the homeless, which is the first of its kind on the West Coast. We've done Shoes for Sacramento, which collects shoes for the homeless in the area. St. John's Program for Real Change, Blessings in a Backpack, which provides food for needy children in the area. We've done reading programs, Lilliput's Children's Services, 916 Inc., which is a reading program in the area. So a lot of ones people have heard of and many that you haven't. So it's a wide variety of services for people across the spectrum who are often forgotten.
Jennifer, I can see why this brings you back year after year.
Absolutely. So fulfilling.
Well, talk to us about this season's highlighted charity, Grant.
This season, we are supporting Lend a Heart, Lend a Hand. It's an animal-assisted therapy organization, and is one of those that is just you wouldn't think of, but it's incredibly needful. These people bring therapy dogs and, in some cases, cats and rabbits. So it's not just dogs, but they bring these animals into various like assisted living facilities and schools and libraries and unique locations, even like the airport, where, as you can imagine, there is, especially recently, levels of high stress.
I've seen the pets there, the dogs there.
Yeah, yeah. And so they're there to help people, you know, relax and have a good experience and get them through difficult times. They bring animals, like I say, to the libraries where they will have kids read to the dogs or to the rabbit, whatever happens to be there. You know, and it's a great way for kids to feel comfortable learning and doing something that, you know, they might not feel comfortable about the reading skills to read to another person, but they'll read to the dog, you know?
Yeah.
So.
What's also exciting is there's going to be a new song that you'll be performing, Jennifer, that was arranged exclusively for RSVP and Dear Darling. How did that come about?
So this is just such a wonderful full circle moment for me in particular, because if you remember, a couple years ago, we did the holiday concert here for Cap Radio, and Dear Darling wasn't Dear Darling yet. They were Cupcake Concert or, you know, some other name. And they performed one of the very first songs they ever wrote together, which was Always. And now, through a mutual friend who's an amazing arranger, Kate Jansen, and also incredible singer, pianist, she has incorporated RSVP into this song. So it's this giant, big double ensemble work now. But it started here, and I'm just so excited about that.
All right, well, give us a little taste of the set list. There's a few songs that we're going to play.
Yeah, so it's holiday time, so we're doing all holiday-themed music right now. It's our first concert back live, so All I Want for Christmas is a really, really great song. So let's hear that.
All I want for Christmas is a house up in the hills with colored lights and music, frosted windowsills filled with all my loved ones, all the old and young ones too. And all I want for Christmas is you.
The harmonizing makes my heart so full.
Yay, me too.
Let's get to the next one.
So Silent Night, it wouldn't be a holiday concert without
yeah.
that.
I just feel immersed in it. It's wonderful. It's also really important to mention, you don't need tickets, right?
No tickets at all. You don't even need a reservation. You just walk in and you sit down.
You show up and you enjoy the good times.
Yes, exactly.
Now, the last song is Some Children See Him. I'm not familiar with this song.
You know, it's a really old tune, Some Children See Him Black and White. And it's just really reflecting that there are so many cultures and there's so many races, and we see through those lenses. Mm.
Some children see him lily white, the baby Jesus born this night. Some children see him lily white, with dresses soft and fair. Some children see him bronze and
all right, for someone who could probably like crack glass with my voice. What kind of collaboration goes into a 20 a cappella ensemble?
You know, it really starts in the audition process. You have to find the voices that do mix well together. There's so many fabulous singers who maybe wouldn't fit that particular blend, but then, you know, you got to have people that are willing to really work at it, and everyone in this group is.
All right, let's now bring in Natalie and Hannah from Dear Darlings. Natalie, how did Dear Darling become involved with RSVP's Winter Series?
Thank you so much, Vicky. Well, it really comes down to friendship and the initial amazing opportunity to be on Cap Radio with Jennifer Reason 2 years ago.
Right, because you both were part of Cap Radio's first holiday concert. What was that experience like, Hannah?
It was really magical. Being someone who plays in Chico, and that's where my main fan base is for my solo stuff, I have a lot of community there, but I'm also a very shy person. So it was great to be kind of pushed in with all these fantastic Sacramento musicians. It was a morning of magic.
What was the inspiration behind the song Believe?
We wrote that song about our experience in the music industry, but I think a lot of people struggle with feelings of, oh gosh, am I doing the right thing? Am I walking the right path? I think it's kind of a universal idea. And also the idea of supporting one another and believing in yourself and trusting yourself the way that your loved ones do.
That clearly resonates with the time that we are yes. in, that is for sure. Let's take a quick listen.
Walking along the sun-paved road, I find myself far from home, chasing dreams and following my plans. Soles of my shoes are wearing thin, I don't think anyone's listening. If they did, they'd understand. Keep some of the good for yourself, hold on to all the good that's left.
I also understand Dear Darling has an album coming out soon. Can you tell me about it, Natalie?
Yes, we are so excited. We have our debut album coming out in the new year in March. And we have the opportunity for folks to pre-order it on our website, deardarlingmusic.com.
Oh, and you all have a third member, right? Casey Lipka. How do the three of you write music collaboratively? Hannah, let's start with you.
Well, it was much nicer before COVID when right. we could all be in the same room.
Actually, but look at human faces. Yeah.
Yeah. We actually adapted and we did a monthly, like 2-day songwriting Zoom. And then, you know, pre-COVID and now that we're vaccinated, we do some week-long writing retreats. And it's really magical and vulnerable and, it's just really meaningful.
Yeah. It sounds incredibly fulfilling. All right, Jennifer, if people are interested in attending, I'm sure there's a lot of people interested, how can they find RSVP?
You know, we try to be everywhere. RSVPchoir.org is the website, but we're on all the socials as well.
Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Vicky.
I imagine you probably like dreaming music.
I surely do.
That is Jennifer Reason, Cap Radio's classical host and artistic director of RSVP. Grant Mulligan is president of RSVP's board of directors. Grant, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much, Vicky.
And Hannah Kyle and Natalie Hagwood are members of the Sacramento music group Dear Darling. Thank you for sharing your work.
Thank you so much, Vicky.
That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you to producers Cynthia Lopez and Nick Dobis, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer is Chris Feltz. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend. We'll catch you back here on Monday. In the meantime, here's Dear Darling, Always.